The story of the solar system is an alluring puzzle, but sometimes picking up the pieces is just as hard as putting them together. You're listening to Western Worlds on astronomy.fm. Hello and welcome back for another conversation here on Western Worlds, an AFM original show heard right here on astronomy.fm. My name is Raymond Francis, and I'm coming to you this week, as every week, from the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration at Western University in London, Ontario, Canada. The basics of solar system formation are thought to be understood. A diffuse nebula collapses under gravity, much of the mass becomes the sun, and as it ignites, materials condense at different distances from it based on temperature. But the details remain unclear. What was that nebula made of? Exactly how did that sorting of rock, ice, and gas by temperature and distance work? Was there mixing or rearrangement of the planets and other bodies after they formed? We can piece together the makeup and organization of the system if we survey the kinds of materials found throughout. But it's difficult to travel to those places, and most of the objects orbiting the sun are too small to detect or study easily with telescopes. But a ready-made supply of samples is literally falling from the sky all the time. Meteorites recovered on the Earth's surface are messengers from every corner of the solar system and conceal within their chemistry the story of the formation and evolution of our solar neighborhood. CPSX's Marianne Mader took part in the 2012 and 13 field season of ANSMET, the Antarctic Search for Meteorites program operated by Case Western Reserve University. The program is sponsored by NASA, the U.S. National Science Foundation, and the Smithsonian Institution. I spoke to Marianne about searching for meteorites, working in Antarctica, and what we can learn from both.
So welcome back to Western Worlds, Marianne.
And, great, thanks.
And welcome back from Antarctica. You've been back for a while, but tell me just how it is that you got to go down there.
Oh, well, it's interesting, actually. There's this program that's been going on in the U.S. for the last 35 years.
35?
Yeah. And it's this program called ANSMET, or the Antarctic Search for Meteorites. And this is a program that's run through university, but funded by the National Science Foundation and NASA. And so currently this program is run by Case Western University, and the principal investigator is Ralph Harvey. And you apply essentially to be a volunteer meteorite hunter if you want to take part in this program. And so you apply to Ralph to be a member, and then he selects the team members. And if you're selected, you get to go.
Okay. And so what's ANSMET doing down there?
So, exactly as the title suggests, they are searching for meteorites. Mm-hmm. We can talk about how that's done if you like.
Sure, yeah. I guess my first question is, why is it done? Why would we bother looking for meteorites?
Yeah, so, well, why bother looking for meteorites at all? That's a good question. They are amazing pieces of evidence of the early solar system that we get to have access to on Earth. They come to us and they land on Earth and we can collect them. Otherwise, we would have to launch these very expensive space missions to collect this kind of material that is, in fact, older than material of the Earth itself.
Well, so they've been flying around in space unmodified for billions of years?
Billions. Yeah. So we're talking about 4.4 billion years in that range. So a lot of this material is actually coming from the asteroid belt.
Okay.
If we're lucky, we're actually also getting pieces of other planets that have been injected off from impacts that happened there. So you can get lunar meteorites or Martian meteorites as well.
Okay. And so this is our way of sampling the solar system.
Yes. Yeah.
And then why Antarctica?
Well, Antarctica is fantastic because, there are several reasons why it's fantastic. One, you can imagine it's easy to find dark rocks, such as meteorites, on white ice. Okay. That's kind of a elementary reason. Another reason is there's a mechanism happening with the ice, the movement of ice in Antarctica, that's actually concentrating this material. So rocky material that's on the ice surface and incorporated into ice is moving. So you can imagine this ice mass is moving from the center of Antarctica to the edges. And it just so happens that there's a mountain range, the Trans-Antarctic Mountain Range, that this ice butts up against. Mm-hmm. And as it does that, the ice slows down. The ice is getting ablated by this very strong wind and basically dropping this load of rocky material, which includes meteorites. Mm-hmm. So you're getting this nice concentration band of meteorites exposed, not hidden by any other elements, not hidden by vegetation, that you can then go out and collect.
So what are the timescales of this kind of motion here? How long does it take for a rock to fall and be incorporated into ice and ride the glacier all the way to where you find it?
Well, that's a great question. And I think that's something that's probably an active area of research. Mm-hmm. But we are talking in the thousands of years.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you're collecting rocks that have been there for quite a while.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. And is Antarctica a popular place for rocks to fall, or is it the same as everywhere else on Earth and it just happens to have this ice?
Yeah, no, it's actually the same everywhere else. I get that question a lot. So this material is following pretty much equally around the Earth, mm-hmm. Kind of equal distribution. But of course, other places on Earth, there's lots of vegetation, there's this giant body of water, mm-hmm. and so it's a lot harder to find this material. When people see falls, say if you see a meteor and say if there are some pieces that come from that. In fact, we had one in Ontario a couple of years ago. People go looking for kind of remnants or meteorites that are landed on Earth, and they're very hard to find. You're looking in fields, urban areas, just it's very difficult to find them. It's literally a needle in the haystack.
Yeah, and it's a rock on a rocky planet.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
Okay. And so is Antarctica the chief place that people go looking? Is this right now, are there other spots on the Earth that are hot spots for looking for meteorites?
So Antarctica is definitely the highest percentage of meteoric material is collected from Antarctica.
Okay.
Other places that are also good to look would be places like deserts. Again, where there's good exposure, it's easier to see dark rocks, mm-hmm. say in this kind of lighter desert.
Okay.
So it's a matter of exposure and, of course, accessibility as well.
Of course. In terms of finding a lot of samples, how many is a lot? How many samples do we have now from Antarctica?
So from Antarctica, from this particular U.S. Antarctic program over the last 35 years, mm-hmm. there's been around 20,000 meteorites collected.
Oh, wow. Okay. 20,000.
Yeah. So and all of these meteorites are collected. They are all returned to NASA. They're all categorized, and they're eventually housed in the Smithsonian collection.
Okay.
And so they're available strictly for science. They are not sold by meteorite dealers or because that there is a business out there for that. Mm-hmm. So these ones are all for science, and researchers can apply to borrow them and do studies on them.
Okay. So while you're in Antarctica, you're doing this work. You're out looking for meteorites. How do you find meteorites? What's this process of looking for them?
So I'd like to say it's very complicated and high tech.
Yeah.
But it's actually very simple.
Okay.
It's really using the strongest sensor we have is our eyes and its eyesight. So we will look for meteorites. If you're looking over a broad area, these teams are between 4 and 8 people. You can each person has their own snowmobile, and so you'll essentially line up in a line in a grid formation and move along looking for dark rocks kind of on the icy surface. Mm-hmm. So you can do that if you're, again, covering a large area where there's not a lot of rocky material on the ice, you're on snowmobiles. We did a lot of searching actually in the year that I went, looking in glacial moraines. So these are large piles of rocks that have been kind of dumped by glaciers.
They've all rode the glacier to that place.
Yeah, exactly. And you can't drive snowmobiles. This is basically piles of rubble. And so so then we stand in a line and we walk very slowly searching this rocky material for meteorites.
Just looking down at your feet.
Yes. And that can be, I guess you could say it could be tedious because there's a lot of rocky material. In the particular area where we were, the local rock that is exposed, because there are these kind of tips of mountains sticking out of the ice called nunataks, mm-hmm. and they get eroded. There's a lot of other black rocky material
Oh, no.
that has a nice glossy sheen mm-hmm. that can look like a meteorite. There's shales and cherts and coal. Any kind of black rock you can think of, I think, was probably also found in these moraines. So we got very good at differentiating between what a meteorite looks like and what a terrestrial rock would look like.
So what does a meteorite look like?
So generally, and I have to say that I was a novice before going. So I did learn this in the field.
Okay.
And so this, I felt like I had a great opportunity to learn this difference because, again, there's so many rocks to compare with. There are other areas in Antarctica where you go and the only thing you're collecting, the only thing you see are meteorites.
Okay.
In our case, that was not true. So typically, the meteorites we were collecting, they are black on the outside, and that's from this melted, thin fusion crust that develops when the meteoroid material is coming through Earth's atmosphere.
Okay.
So it's, again, black. It has this kind of sheen, which is, I'm not even really sure how to describe it, but it is kind of a unique sheen to meteorites. They tend to have rounded edges. They won't necessarily be perfectly spherical.
Yeah.
But not sharp edges. So if they have a corner, it won't necessarily be a sharp corner to a tip. It'll be rounded in some way. Depending on the meteorite type, if it's more metallic, they could have these kind of thumbprint impressions on the surface called regmoglyphs. We did not see any kind of pure metallic, we didn't see any of those features on meteorites that we collected. Mm-hmm. But that is something that you can see. So ours were typically kind of this blackish material, rounded. Sometimes if they're broken open, you can see that the inside is made up of these tiny spheres, which is also characteristic of ordinary chondrites.
Okay.
Made up of chondrules.
And I'm interested in these thumbprint features. Where does that come from? Why do metallic asteroids, or meteorites rather, have those?
So to my knowledge, and again, I'm not a meteorologist, but they're developing when the material is coming through our atmosphere. So you're getting these kind of thumbprint impressions forming from that ablation process.
Little kind of hollow pits.
Yeah, they're not so deep. It's really like a thumbprint impression, if you're picturing that in clay.
Anyway, so that's it then. You get your metallic ones and your dark, rocky ones with the rounded corners and the sheen, and they stand out, do they, from other rocks?
They do. We had some other volcanic rock in the area that was brownish black, kind of exterior with the sheen. And what's difficult is if the whole surface is covered in the sheen. So, for example, if it was a meteorite, the entire thing is covered in fusion crust, where none of it's broken off, then you can't look inside the sample. So it could be difficult to tell if that is in fact a meteorite versus a terrestrial rock. Now, most meteorites are magnetic, so they have some metallic component. Of course, some terrestrial rocks are magnetic,
right.
Particularly when you're talking about a basaltic rock or something like that. It can also be magnetic. So I am not sure yet, and I guess it'll be reported next year at a planetary conference, what percentage of the rocks we collected were in fact meteorites and what percentage were terrestrial rocks.
Right.
I suspect there was some terrestrial rocks collected that just happened to have that effect.
So I've been in the field with geologists, and when they want to see what a rock is like, they very quickly pull out the hammer and break it open. Do you do this, or do you just grab it?
No. There are very strict protocols about how to observe, handle, and collect the meteorites.
Okay.
By no means can we smash it open. We cannot. You're not meant to touch it with your bare skin. Mm-hmm. So it's collected with sterilized tongs, put inside a sterilized bag. Before it's done, then of course we photograph it. It's been given an identification number so that it can be tracked later. So once it's packaged up in this sterilized bag and taped, that's it. We don't open it again.
Okay.
We bring it back to camp and we store it in kind of a cooler box. And in fact, they're kept frozen the entire time from Antarctica on their journey back to NASA where they're categorized.
How come?
So that's part of preservation because they're sitting in snow. If that melts, I mean, the process of kind of weathering could start occurring. And so you want to keep it preserved in the pristine state as much as possible.
Okay. So here you are, you're in Antarctica, you're running around on foot or on snowmobiles looking for rocks. What is the routine that enables that? What's daily life like in Antarctica supporting this kind of search?
Yeah, actually, that's also, I don't want to say strict protocol, but they've been doing this for 35 years, and so it's pretty routine at this point in terms of how camp life is. Mm-hmm. So you certainly have a daily routine. In the field, there is a kind of a safety mountaineer guide who's part of the team, whose responsibility is the safety of the entire crew. There's someone who's in charge of science, so essentially it will either be the principal investigator or someone working in that capacity who makes the science decisions. And these two people together on a daily basis will decide, is it safe, first of all, to go searching for meteorites? And there are several factors to consider, most importantly, weather. And if it is, then the science officer has a game plan of where we're going to go searching for that day. And so we kind of go through our daily routines. We live in tents. We're not living in a research base, mm-hmm. so we're living out in the field, and there are two people living in one tent together, and they're kind of a team. So with your tent mate, you cook your meals together, you kind of operate, do kind of all those logistical kind of home life things. That's your kind of partner in crime. So, you know, a daily typical day, you kind of get up, you have your breakfast, organize your stuff, get your snowmobile ready, you hear about the plan for the day. We'll all go out searching. We'll have lunch. We've packed our lunch in the morning, have lunch in the ice, and then do our collecting and come on back. And then, of course, back at camp, there are several chores that need to be done, including storing the meteorites and then regular routine things of surviving and eating.
Right. And what's the environment like? What are the temperatures and what the weather you have to deal with?
So they can vary quite a bit. We were very fortunate where we were located in that I would say the average temperature was maybe minus 18 degrees Celsius to minus 20, minus 25.
Well, that's not so bad.
But that is not taking into account the wind chill.
Oh, right.
Because I was actually recording the temperature every day. The wind chill is the major factor. Mm-hmm. So if winds are below 15 knots, then that's okay. It's perfectly fine to go out searching. Once they start picking up to 20 knots and beyond, there's a concern for safety. Mm. And this is because it's where we are, it's a polar desert, so it's not snowing. But once the wind picks up, it can pick up snow on the surface and cause whiteout conditions.
Right.
Which are very dangerous.
For just getting lost? Or?
Yeah, for visibility. Certainly for getting lost.
Yeah.
It could be difficult even seeing 5 meters away from you. So you can imagine if you're in snowmobiles and your partner is 10 meters away, it can be very disorienting.
Right.
So that is one of the primary safety concerns for sure.
Okay. And when you're at this field site, how far are you from the closest human beings? How far are you from base?
Yeah, this particular field site, we were about... I might need to look at a map, a couple hundred kilometers away from the South Pole.
Okay.
And that would be the closest U.S. research base. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure about if there was any smaller kind of field camps or anything nearby. Mm-hmm. But to my knowledge, South Pole was kind of our main kind of safety haven if it should be needed.
Okay.
And you can get to there by plane. Mm-hmm. So we would need to be somewhere where a plane could safely land and kind of get to us.
Just on the ice someplace. You're not
exactly
next to an airport.
No. So where we landed, because when we flew into our campsite, we used these very large planes, mm-hmm. these Hercules U.S. military planes, that can only land in particular areas. So we landed in an area where it's kind of a known area that's good as a runway. Mm-hmm. And then from there, we had to move our camp about 40 kilometers, and we moved by snowmobile using sleds, kind of like we were the sled dogs and had all our gear packed up on sleds. So that was the closest area that the larger plane could land.
Okay.
Where we moved to at our camp, our mountaineer guide actually had brought a groomer to groom a track so that a twin otter, which is a much smaller plane, could land. And throughout the season, we had a drop-off of some food supplies using the twin otter.
And how long was that season? How long were you in there?
So in total, we were probably in the field about 6 to 7 weeks. So that's the camping side of it. And then on either end, when we first went to Antarctica, We were in McMurdo Base Station, which is the largest U.S. Research base in Antarctica, for about 2 weeks for training, safety training, getting our gear ready. And same thing, when we got out of the field, we were also there for a period of time putting gear away and things like that.
Okay. And so now that you're back, you plan to do this again?
I would love to.
Yeah?
Yeah, going to Antarctica was honestly a life dream of mine. I realized that this was a great opportunity, how I could accomplish that. This program, again, it operates by kind of having this volunteer pool of people who can go. Once you've gone and you're a veteran, your chances of going again are much higher than if you're a, kind of a new novice applying to get in.
They like experienced people?
Exactly. Because you've gone through it, you've shown that you're capable of doing it for one thing, and you also know the process and how it's done.
Well, good luck with that. Maybe we'll get to see you go again.
Thank you. And I just wanted to let everyone know that the Antarctic field season is happening this year. There was concern with the U.S. government shutdown that it maybe would be canceled, but they will be leaving, and they're leaving at the end of this month. The season will be a little bit shorter, and there's going to be one main team searching. And you can follow along. There is a blog for Ann Smet. So if you Googled A-N-S-M-E-T, you'd probably find that blog. And they will be blogging during the season with updates.
Great. And in fact, they can see your blog from last year on the CBS.
Exactly, website. Yes. Yeah. Yes, I was part of that last season.
Great. Well, thanks a lot.
No problem. Thanks.
Talk to you again soon.
You're listening to Western Worlds on astronomy.fm. Let's go to the discussion.
So Marianne's trip to Antarctica isn't exactly a relaxing vacation, but it sounds like an interesting trip.
I think it's... I was reading her blogs when she was there, and I think it's awesome. I think that would be a perfect way to spend a vacation. You're like, you're in a new, completely different continent.
Yeah.
And away from most of the population of Earth, and looking for something which is interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, and I guess it's worth mentioning that, yeah, she did write a blog that's posted on the CPSX website, cpsx.ca.
Yeah.
And it comes with some photos, so there's a photo gallery.
Yeah.
I think it's titled Antarctic Dispatches. So you can go to cpsx.ca, click on gallery, and it's one of the choices there. And you can see what she was up to out there.
They're amazing pictures. You wouldn't expect. You know, it would be like, it's a polar desert.
Yeah.
But they're amazing pictures. They also have pictures of the meteorites they found and how they actually do all the science behind it. Look, like, you know, how they decide if it is a meteorite. They take a picture, how they take the sample, how they put it, you know, they store it in the bag, which is frozen until it gets, which she was talking about. You can actually see all that in the pictures.
Yeah, no, that's really cool. And you get some documentation of that process.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, what a complex operation of getting people to New Zealand and then Antarctica, mm-hmm. and providing them with the equipment and flying in snowmobiles and
yeah. things. That sounds fun.
Yeah.
It sounds a fun adventure, I would say.
But it's a lot of work.
Yeah.
As you were saying, sometimes they didn't have the machines and they were dragging all their equipment themselves on sleds and things.
In minus 25.
Yeah. So. Yeah. And then there's wind and then there's, you know, it's,
I'm sure it's not the minus 25 we have here in Canada. It's probably way colder.
It's a harsh environment.
Yeah.
And, you know, we talk about working in space analog type mm-hmm. environments. This one surely makes the cut.
Yeah. I mean, if you want to go to Europa, probably, I don't know, something like that.
Yeah, but even as like an operational analog, like mm-hmm. if you go outside in Antarctica, sometimes it isn't habitable.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's too cold. You can mm-hmm. get, you know, temperatures of minus 40 and colder, and wind chills that
track to minus 60.
Yeah, equivalently many, many degrees colder than that.
So
you can't just go outside,
mm-hmm.
and you're completely reliant on the technology that you bring with you, from the tent to the snowmobile to the airplane that brings you in.
Mm-hmm.
It's and you're isolated with a small group of people. There's no one around.
Yeah. And, I mean, you have this tent buddy that you hang out with most of the time.
Yeah.
Yeah, I always wanted to know if the tent is heated or not. I mean, I surely wouldn't want to sleep in my snow gear.
Yeah, it's. I think it is. We can ask Mary.
I hope it is.
Yeah, I think so.
I hope it is.
Yeah.
I mean, I would love to go on an adventure like that if the tent is hot enough to sleep in.
Yeah. No, I've never heard describing how hot it gets actually in the tent. So.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. Then it's good. But the way she got to go was interesting as well. There's this program where you, I think you write a letter, and then
you keep writing
until you get in.
Yeah.
And then I think if I remember from what I talked about, was like fifth time she wrote it or something.
It
was a couple of times.
Usually it's a few tries.
Yeah, a few tries, and she got in. And I think it's very interesting. Like you don't have to be, you know, a person who does meteorite studies. Mm-hmm. You can basically be a person who is interested in doing something scientific, and having maybe a bit of knowledge, but that's it. And then you basically go in. They give you the training you need to go look for meteorites, which obviously aren't same as the rocks,
mm-hmm.
and you need to know how to distinguish them from the rest of the rocks.
And they'll teach you that.
They'll teach you that. And you don't have to be this expert in meteorites to actually go do that. And I think that is very interesting. Anyone who is interested in looking for meteorites can just go.
Well, not just anyone, but anyone with a passion for exploring, going to a very harsh environment and doing science.
Yeah.
And they're looking for these skills that Parshad mentions. Because you've got to, if you're going to be in an environment like that, you have got to have people that you can rely on.
Yeah.
Right? People that you believe are going to work well in difficult environments when things get tough.
Yeah.
When they were there, I guess they had bad weather for a few days.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
As we found out on the blog, right?
Yes.
And
whiteout conditions.
Yeah, and they were stuck they couldn't see anything, couldn't go anywhere.
Yeah, they couldn't even get out of their tent.
That's right.
If I remember correctly.
Basically. And so they're stuck there.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's not possible to get an aircraft in. If something goes wrong, you know. So you got to be ready to stay out there with your small team of people for a long time. And actually, while that was happening, while Marianne was in the field, there was an aircraft that crashed in Antarctica.
Oh.
A Canadian Twin Otter aircraft that was providing Antarctic logistics. And we didn't know at first whether she would have been on that plane or not.
Oh.
As it turns out, she was not.
Okay.
It wasn't related to ANSMET.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's you rely on that technology, and they were, the aircraft basically flew into the side of a mountain that they couldn't see because of the visual conditions.
Yeah, I mean, she was talking about how they had to take this lure and make a runway for the plane to land.
Yep.
Which it doesn't sound, you know, normal unless you live in Alaska or maybe northern Canada, or Antarctica, but that's really, you know, interesting to see. You know how people do their science; they rely on this supply of material that comes in only if the weather is good, and only if there's a good runway to land on. So if the weather wasn't good for a week, you'd probably run out of supplies. Or I'm assuming they would have a stock, but you know, you still rely on.
Yeah, this is the kind of logistic support that you have to work with.
And I think this would nicely extrapolate to if you were to go to Mars. What if you launch something from here, you know, and it kind of crashes in the middle or something? It doesn't get to Mars where people are living there, trying to do scientific work, and they need their supplies. You know, this would be the kind of adventure that we normally talk about. Where you need this constant supply of people, of supplies to keep running the scientific missions that we have.
Yeah, and even, you know, even in northern Canada, we have to deal with these kind of things. There's communities that are only connected by air.
Yeah.
And they get a once a year, what they call sea lift. They get a shipment by water once a year.
Yeah.
And everything else comes in by aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
And so if the weather's bad for a while, they've got to make do.
Yeah. And I also like the fact that, you know, how, comparatively how easy it is to look for meteorites in Antarctica than it would be anywhere else in the world. And she just describes it very nicely why it would be so important to just go to Antarctica and look for them. Even though I think she was talking about how most of their mission was they were not looking on the ice, which is how normal, normally where they would look. Because then if you're moving on ice, you see a dark colored rock lying in the middle of nowhere. And you'd be like, okay, that's interesting because there's only this one rock. But then when they were looking in the rock beds, like where there were many other rocks. And if you go to the gallery, you will be able to see the pictures where there are like tons of rocks. And then they pick out this really tiny rock, which you wouldn't assume is as a meteorite unless you know what you're looking for.
Yeah.
So I think that was very interesting.
Yeah, it's definitely a visual skill that you have to pick up.
Yeah.
And you have to do that very, very patiently and meticulously in harsh conditions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's 30 below and you're walking in the wind and the sun.
Yeah.
And you're carefully scanning.
It would be very tiring, I would assume.
For sure. And you have to have that patience and discipline because that's your job for the whole time you're there.
Yeah.
That's our show for this week. Western Worlds is a co-production of the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration and Astronomy.fm. Western Worlds was created by John Moores. This episode was produced by Parshati Patel and Michael Forster and featured an interview by co-host Raymond Francis. Our roundtable discussion featured co-hosts Parshati Patel, Raymond Francis, and Zengi Hu. Our editors were Anna Noon and Parshati Patel, and I'm Raymond Francis. Our theme music is Heliosheath by Sean Kim. You can continue the conversation online and listen to past episodes or learn more about Western Worlds by visiting our website at cpsx.uwo.ca/westernworlds. You can also email us at westernworlds@uwo.ca. On Twitter, we are @WWAFM, and on Facebook, we are facebook.com/westernworlds. On behalf of everyone here at Western Worlds, I'd like to thank you for joining us tonight. I hope you can make world enough in time to join us again next week, right here on astronomy.fm.